Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. Welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program that helps you learn American English. It's Monday, December 14th, 2015. It was on this day in 1972, 43 years ago, that American astronaut Eugene Cernan walked on the moon. He was the last person to do so. Today on the program, we'll tell you about the slow destruction of the atmosphere on the planet Mars.
When we look at ancient Mars, we see a different type of surface, one that had valleys that looked like they were carved by water.
Then, as we always do on Mondays, we will bring you the technology report. This week, we'll tell you about how science fiction is becoming reality through a new sampling technology called environmental DNA. Scientists are using it to identify rare or invasive species, study biodiversity, or estimate fish populations with just a small amount of air or water. And finally, as we do every weekday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we will tell you about the growing tensions between Congress and the new president, Andrew Johnson, in the years following the end of the Civil War. Radical members of the new Republican Party controlled Congress. The party had been formed to oppose slavery. Members of the party wanted to punish the southern states that left the Union and lost the war. President Johnson opposed the efforts. He was a Democrat. He stopped a number of programs that he thought interfered with rights given to the states by the Constitution. So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day here on As It Is, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English. Because we exist to help you learn everyday American English, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Scientists have been noticing that Mars is losing its atmosphere. They have been trying to determine why. Last month, one of them answered the question with a song. Michael Meyer is the lead scientist for NASA's Mars Exploration Program. The answer is blowing in the wind, he said. That sentence is from a song written by Bob Dylan. NASA scientists say winds from the sun are slowly destroying Mars' atmosphere. Ann Ball has more for us now.
Bruce Jakoski is principal investigator on the MAVEN team. MAVEN stands for Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution. It is a spacecraft that collects information from Mars as it circles the planet. Today, Mars has a thin atmosphere. It is cold and dry, with a desert-like environment. Jakoski says it used to be much different.
When we look at ancient Mars, we see a different type of surface, one that had valleys that looked like they were carved by water, lakes that were standing for long periods of time. We see an environment that was much more able to support liquid water.
NASA scientists have used the phrase "follow the water" in their work to understand Mars. Recently, they found a kind of liquid water that flows with salt down a mountain area of the planet. But it is not always there. Scientist Michael Meyer describes what they found.
We're seeing water with the salt that's able to flow down the sides of a cliff. Why is this important? That means there's water on Mars, on the surface of Mars today.
Scientists already knew that ice exists at the polar caps of Mars. So why is it important to find liquid water? Meyer explains.
It means that we have a resource. And when we're looking at sending humans to Mars, water is one of the key things that we need to have, not only for the astronauts to drink, but also to make oxygen, to make fuel. And so having a ready resource there on the planet makes a big difference in terms of how much stuff you have to bring with you.
Sending humans to Mars is still in the distant future. NASA is aiming for the 2030s. The space agency has even started a recruiting campaign to hire new astronauts. Those chosen might fly any number of space vehicles still in development. Both U.S. government and private industries are developing rockets and spacecraft to get people to Mars. Many questions need to be answered. How do you protect humans from radiation in space? How do you grow food in spaceships on the way to Mars? How do they grow food once they arrive on Mars? Having access to water on the planet will be critical to that effort. Whether there is life on Mars remains unanswered, but some scientists say they think there might be some kind of microbial life on the planet. Michael Meyer is more cautious, saying it has yet to be proven. He says there could be life there today, if it ever got started there in the first place. Finding life, however small, on another planet in our solar system would be so exciting.
Whether or not there's life on Mars doesn't matter whether or not I think so or don't think so. I'm a scientist. I want to go and find out. The real point is, we don't know, but it's a good question. It's a reasonable question. It's something we should be pursuing. Because imagine how exciting that would be to find evidence of life somewhere else, not on our planet.
And that, finding life on another planet, would certainly change the way we view the whole universe. I'm Ann Ball.
That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. We truly want to hear what interests you. Write to us. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. That's learningenglish@voanews.com. And please know that we read every message you send us. The Technology Report, and The Making of a Nation are next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from VOA Learning English Headquarters in Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Many science fiction stories tell about explorers arriving in a new world. The explorers then use some kind of high-tech device to test for breathable air or signs of life. But here on Earth, science fiction is becoming reality through a new sampling technology called environmental DNA, or eDNA for short. Scientists can use it to identify rare or invasive species, study biodiversity, or estimate fish populations with just a little air or water. Ryan Kelly is an ecologist at the School of Marine and Environmental Affairs at the University of Washington in Seattle. He works in a laboratory there with other researchers. They study the genetic material released by living creatures.
Essentially, we can take a sample of whether it's soil or air, and in our case, water, and we can sequence the DNA out of it and tell you what's there.
Ryan Kelly says he and his research team are studying water samples collected from Puget Sound. He says the cost of gene sequencing has plummeted in recent years. That makes DNA testing more widely available. Environmental DNA can be used in two ways. One is to identify the creatures that live in a certain place. The other is to confirm the presence or lack of a specific creature. Karen Goldberg heads the new eDNA lab at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. She is one of the first biologists in the northwestern United States to take the technology from the testing phase to actually using it.
It's extremely useful for species that are really hard to find. I have spent many hours looking for species that I was pretty sure were there, looking under rocks, looking in water, doing all kinds of surveys.
Karen Goldberg sees eDNA as a way to get answers more efficiently, safely, and with less destruction compared to traditional survey techniques. Until recently, scientists depended on snorkeling, netting, or using an electric current to temporarily capture fish.
We're absolutely at this point where proof of concept has been established. I don't think everyone necessarily is on board yet, but I think a majority of the people are on board.
This newer way to identify what lives in the environment is becoming popular around the world. Animal experts in Vietnam are using the eDNA to find the last wild Yangtze giant softshell turtles. One researcher on the Caribbean island of Trinidad is using the sampling technology to find endangered golden tree frogs. And in Madagascar, it is being used to identify amphibian diseases. Ms. Goldberg has used eDNA testing to confirm the local extinction, disappearance, of a leopard frog in the American state of Idaho. She has also been asked to document the spread of the New Zealand mud snail in the state of Washington. The creature has been found in lakes and other waterways across the state. Now, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management wants Karen Goldberg to look for the Columbia spotted frog in two other western states. The rare amphibian is a candidate for the federal government's threatened species list. Scientists working with the technology say they do not expect robots to replace field biologists anytime soon. But the old-fashioned fieldwork could soon be more targeted. A related research goal is to show how long environmental DNA can last and how far it can travel in different environments. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation. The Civil War ended in 1865. After that, tensions grew between Congress and the new president, Andrew Johnson. The Republican Party was still new. It was formed to oppose slavery. Radical members of the party controlled Congress. They wanted strong policies to punish the southern states that left the Union and lost the war. Standing in the way of the Republicans was Andrew Johnson, a Democrat. The president opposed radical efforts to force solutions on the South. He vetoed a number of programs that he thought interfered with rights given to the states by the Constitution. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of President Andrew Johnson.
In the congressional elections of 1866, radicals won firm control of both houses of Congress. They were able to pass a number of bills over the president's veto. But Johnson refused to stand aside in the face of radical attempts to seize all powers of government. This conflict between Johnson and the Congress caused much bitterness. Finally, the radicals decided to get him out of the way. For the first time in American history, Congress would try to remove the president from office. Under the United States Constitution, the House of Representatives has the power to bring charges against the president. The Senate acts as the jury to decide if the president is guilty of the charges. The Chief Justice of the United States serves as judge. If 2/3 of the senators find the president guilty, he can be removed from office.
Radicals in the House of Representatives brought 11 charges against President Johnson. Most of the charges were based on Johnson's removal from office of his Secretary of War. Radicals charged that this violated a new law. The law said the president could not remove a cabinet officer without approval by the Senate. Johnson refused to recognize the law. He said it was not constitutional. Radicals in the House of Representatives also charged Johnson with criticizing Congress. They said his statements dishonored Congress and the presidency.
The great impeachment trial began on March 5, 1868. The president refused to attend, but his lawyers were there to defend him. One by one, the senators swore an oath to be just. They promised to make a fair and honest decision on the guilt or innocence of Andrew Johnson. A congressman from Massachusetts opened the case for the radicals. He told the senators not to think of themselves as members of any court. He said the Senate was a political body that was being asked to settle a political question. Was Johnson the right man for the White House? He said it was clear that Johnson wanted to overthrow Congress. Other radical Republicans then joined him in condemning Johnson. They made many charges, but they offered little evidence to support the charges.
Johnson's lawyers called for facts instead of emotion. They said the Constitution required the radicals to prove that the president had committed serious crimes. Andrew Johnson had committed no crime, they said. This was purely a political trial. They warned of serious damage to the American form of government if the president was removed for political reasons. No future president would be safe, they said, if opposed by a majority of the House and two-thirds of the Senate.
The trial went on day after day. The decision would be close. 54 senators would be voting. 36 votes of guilty were needed to remove the president from office. It soon became clear that the radicals had 35 of these votes. Only 7 senators remained undecided. If one of the 7 voted guilty, Johnson would be removed. Radicals put great pressure on the 7 men. They tried to buy their votes. Party leaders threatened them. Supporters in the senators' home states were told to write hundreds of letters demanding that Johnson be found guilty.
A senator from Maine was one who felt the pressure, but he refused to let it force him to do what others wished. He answered one letter this way: "Sir, I wish you and all my other friends to know that I, not they, am sitting in judgment upon the president. I, not they, have sworn to do impartial justice. I, not they, am responsible to God and man for my action and its results." A senator from Kansas was another who refused to let pressure decide his vote. He said, "I trust that I shall have the courage to vote as I judge best."
In the final days before the vote, 6 of the 7 remaining Republican senators let it be known that they would vote not guilty. But the senator from Kansas still refused to say what his vote would be. His was the only vote still in question. His vote would decide the issue. Now the pressure on him increased. His brother was offered $20,000 for information about how the senator would vote. Everywhere he turned, he found someone demanding that he vote guilty. The vote took place on May 16th. Every seat in the big Senate room was filled. The Chief Justice began to call on the senators. One by one, they answered guilty or not guilty. Finally, he called the name of the senator from Kansas.
The senator stood up. He looked about him. every voice was still. Every eye was upon him. It was like looking down into an open grave, he said later. Friendship, position, wealth, everything that makes life desirable to an ambitious man were about to be swept away by my answer. He spoke softly. Many could not hear him. The Chief Justice asked him to repeat his vote. This time, the answer was clearly heard across the room. Not guilty.
The trial was all but done. Remaining senators voted as expected. The Chief Justice announced the result. On the first charge, 35 senators voted that President Johnson was guilty. 19 voted that he was not guilty. The radicals had failed by one vote. When the Senate voted on the other charges, the result was the same. The radicals could not get the 2/3 majority they needed. President Johnson was declared not guilty.
Radical leaders and newspapers bitterly denounced the small group of Republican senators who refused to vote guilty. They called them traitors. Friends and supporters condemned them. None was re-elected to the Senate or to any other government office. It was a heavy price to pay. And yet they were sure they had done the right thing. The senator from Kansas told his wife, "The millions of men cursing me today will bless me tomorrow for having saved the country from the greatest threat it ever faced."
He was right. The trial of Andrew Johnson was an important turning point in the making of the American nation. His removal from office would have established the idea that the president could serve only with the approval of Congress. The president would have become, in effect, a prime minister. He would have to depend on the support of Congress to remain in office. Johnson's victory kept alive the idea of an independent presidency. However, the vote did not end the conflict between Congress and the White House over the future of the South. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by David Jarmel and Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe.